Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's special meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Marcela Medina, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and Vice President General Manager of KDTV, Univision Channel 14, and KFSF Telefutura 66 here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm your chair for this evening. We also welcome our listeners on radio and television, and we invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. We also wish to thank Bank of America for its generous sponsorship of tonight's program. Tonight's distinguished speaker, Rita Moreno, is the next recipient of Commonwealth Club's medallion awarded to a select group of individuals who have positively shaped our era. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our celebrated guest. Before she comes down, let me tell you a little bit about her. Rita Moreno was born as Rosa Dolores Alverio on December 11, 1931, in Humacao, Puerto Rico. And she is the first and only Hispanic actress to have won an Emmy, Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. Rosita, as she was called, came from a family of jíbaros, or small independent farmers, who had land at the end, right at the edge of the El Yunque rainforest in Puerto Rico. Rosita moved with her mother to New York City when she was 5 years old, and started her career in the entertainment industry at a very young age. She had her first role on Broadway by the time she was 13, and at that age already caught the attention of Hollywood talent scouts. She appeared in a film called So Young, So Bad. And soon after, Rosita Moreno, using the surname of her mother's third husband, shortened her first name to Rita. And this was at the request of MGM studio chief at the time, Louis B. Mayer, and at the time she signed her very first movie deal. She then went on for the next 10 years to play a number of roles in which she was cast in movies as either a very fiery Latin sex kitten or an Indian maiden, all roles which she considered really were quite degrading. But finally, in 1961, she landed the role of Anita in the film adaptation of Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim's Broadway hit, West Side Story. She also appeared in Singing in the Rain in 1952, The King and I in 1956, and Carnal Knowledge in 1971. In the 70s and 80s, she appeared on the PBS children's series The Electric Company and also the popular family variety show The Muppet Show. She's also made guest appearances on The Rockford Files, The Love Boat, The Cosby Show, Golden Girls, Miami Vice, among others. All in all, she's appeared in more than 40 feature films and was given a Hollywood Star Walk of Fame in 1965. She is the recipient of many, many awards and has served on the National Endowment for the Arts as commissioner and on the President's White House Fellowship Committee, and she also has been on the Committee for the Arts and Humanities. Throughout all of this, she's also been involved and dedicated to fighting AIDS, and more recently became involved as a spokesperson for the American Heart Association, where she really is working to try to attack and address cardiovascular disease and also diabetes, adult onset diabetes. Currently, she is appearing at the Berkeley Rep as Amanda Wingfield in the Glass Menagerie, where, I'm told, just this very evening, she has broken her own record from when she played Maria Callas in Masterclass. And joining her here this evening are her husband and daughter, who I'm sure she will also have the pleasure of introducing. Please join me in giving a very, very warm welcome to Miss Rita Moreno.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely introduction. Thank you so much. before I get into the main subject of today's talk, which will deal with film and the role of minorities in Hollywood movie making, I think I should tell you a little bit about myself. Actually, you heard quite a bit, which curtails what I was going to say, but never mind. I was born in Puerto Rico in 1931, which makes me 74. What the hell? The funny thing is that whenever I mention my age, there's always some lady in the audience who turns to her husband and says, well, if she admits to 74, she's got to be at least 78. From the book, You Can't Win for Losing. My mother and I came to the United States and to a Puerto Rican at that time. The United States was New York City. When I was 5 years old, we came by ship. We couldn't afford an airplane in those days. That was for very wealthy people. And I had a memorable first day in America. It took place in the harbor. When I looked at that enormous lady holding the torch, and I said to myself, oh, my goodness. A lady runs this country. A little prescient, but boy, is it ever due now. What was difficult about coming to this country is that we arrived in January. It was freezing. And if you know anything at all about Puerto Rico, the coldest thing that happens is a trade wind. And we were cold, and the views were rather depressing. It was just gray concrete. And I kept saying to my mama, where are the palm trees? Where's the bougainvillea? What happened to us? But the other thing that was extremely difficult about the first couple of years here was the language. What an impossible language English is. So many rules made to be broken sometimes. Now, my mother was no different from many other Latina mothers. She had enormous difficulties with the language. And she used to juxtapose certain letters, J and Y. Well, she would say juxtaposed. And, for instance, every Saturday in our little ghetto apartment, because it was just my mother and myself, no papa, Saturday was the day in which the apartment got cleaned up. But my mama wouldn't say it that way. She would say, oh, my goodness gracious, let me see, today is Saturday. That means it's time to change the sheets. Yeah, it's funny now. And then one memorable afternoon, a hot, hot afternoon in New York City, humid, my little girlfriend, Angela, because, you know, that was her wives were all like that, yes, I am wearing my pajamas. Angela came to have a play date with me at the apartment, and it was really a terribly, blisteringly hot day. And my mom started to pace up and down the apartment, fanning herself, saying, ay, Dios mío, que no aguante este calor. I tell you, it's too hot to do any work today. So I'll tell you what we are going to do, girls. We are going to pack a picnic lunch and have a nice swim at the beach. Well, I needn't tell you, Angela spent the day going... I was so mortified, and I took my mother aside. I said, ay, mami, mami, bendito sea Dios, mami, te ruego, mami, mami. A-E-I-O-U. Can't you say peach? Can't you at least say sheets? And she said, no, I can't. And I said, why, mommy? And she said, because I got trouble with my bowels. Many years later, I met the man of my dreams, a nice Jewish doctor. That's redundant, isn't it? Named Leonard Gordon. And can you just imagine how thrilled both families were when they found out that we wanted to marry? Oh, there was singing and dancing in the streets that day. Ay, bendito! Ay, gewollt! Ay, ay! And I thought, I'm going to have to do something about this. So I went to my mom. I said, listen, mom, I think what I have to do is go to Lenny's house and meet his family and make peace. She said, a wonderful idea. You go over there and make peace. Okay. So I, well, to her, the book was called War and Peace. I went there. Everything went fine. You got the usual Jewish thing, as long as you love him and you're good to him. Fine. That went very well. About 2 weeks later, Lenny showed up at our apartment. My mom opened the door, looked at him, put her hand on her hip, and she said to him, Jew, are you? And Lenny, poor man, said, what? Are you, are you? He was so embarrassed and nervous. He actually said, yes, I am. Meantime, we've been married forever, so 41 years. So I think we handled that one. So that in a very small almond shell is the beginnings of my life. I just wanted to inform you of where I come from so that what I would tell you about the movies has something to do with me. Movies, as we know them, got their start at the beginning of the 1900s. And by 1920, movies had become a major industry. It's an interesting and little-known fact that in great measure, the rapid growth from fledgling start to a full-blown industry can be credited to a small group of courageous and far-sighted Jewish hat makers, furriers, glove manufacturers, and suit salesmen from the East Coast of the United States, whose knowledge of the entertainment industry was practically non-existent, but who were nonetheless willing to lend their time, their money, and their business talents to what appeared to be a huge risk venture. You see, traditionally and historically, Jews, prior to modern times, were excluded from most industries and were allowed to engage in enterprises marked by enormous financial risks in every country in which they resided. So, following tradition, they ventured into this new yet untried industry called motion pictures. It was an area that did not attract the other industrialists of the time. So it was these forward-thinking men who were willing to risk time, money, and talent who created a dream world called Hollywood, and by controlling that dream, hoped to enter the American mainstream. The eldest of these gentlemen was Carl Lemele, who was born in a small village in Germany in 1867, came to America, where he settled in the Midwest, where he worked in a variety of jobs, never earning more than $18 a week. He would eventually found Universal Studios. And when he and a small group of other investors had formed this entity, they were pressed at a meeting to find a name for the company. And Lemele, who was sitting behind the desk in a swivel chair, just thoughtfully turned his chair around, looked out the window in back of him, and said, wait a minute, I've got it. I've got the name. Universal, because that's what we're supplying. Universal Entertainment for the Universe. Several months later, one of the people who was at the meeting came up to him and said, listen, that was really an inspired idea. How did you come up with that name? And he said, well, you may recall that I was looking out the window and I saw a truck go by, and on the side of it was printed Universal Pipe Fittings. So much for inspiration. Adolf Zucker was born in a small Hungarian village and was orphaned by the time he was 5 years of age. He was sent to live with a stern, unloving uncle and emigrated to America, where he plunged into assimilation. He became a fairly successful furrier. But he, too, in a circuitous manner, found his way to Hollywood, where he would build Paramount Pictures. William Fox, another Hungarian, the young boy sold sandwiches and soda and worked as a chimney sweep. A chimney sweep. He eventually entered the garment industry and, with money that he saved, purchased a small movie house in Brooklyn and would eventually parlay all of these entrepreneurial experiences into the Fox Film Corporation. And then there was Harry Cohn, born of a father who was a German Jew and a mother who came from Russia. He grew up on the Upper East Side, where his father ran a small tailor shop. Now, it's been said that early in his life, Harry Cohn probably declared war on the world. Much has been written about this profane, cruel, rapacious, philandering mogul who delighted in bragging that, and I believe he's the first to say this, I don't get ulcers, I give them. He was so universally feared and hated that after thousands of people attended his funeral, Red Skelton, a very famous and successful comedian of the day, said, well, you see, it only proves what they always say. Give the public something they want to see and they'll come out for it. Harry Cohn had helped to create Columbia Studios, which he ruled with an iron fist. I remember meeting him and being scared to death of him. What a tough customer he was. Whew, it was very scary. Warner Brothers Studios was formed by Sam, Harry, and Jack Warner, but it was Harry and Jack who ran the studio. The fact that the studio could turn out the film, the number of films that it did, was really rather remarkable, since Harry and Jack loathed one another and at times had to be restrained from injuring one another. True. The hostility was so intense that neither brother would enter the studio if the other were there. Now, this studio was not noted for the quality of its films, but it did have one historic triumph. On October 6th, 1927, a date that would forever be engraved in motion picture history, Warner Brothers released a film called The Jazz Singer, which heralded the beginning of the sound era. What is ironic is that although they began the talkies, Harry and Jack never spoke to one another. Louis B. Mayer claimed that he had forgotten where in Russia he was born or what was the date of his birth. So with typical extravagance, he adopted the 4th of July as his birthday. In that way, all the festivities associated with that date would be, of course, become a tribute not only marking the birth of a great nation, but a tribute to a man who would head the greatest studio of them all, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Now, there was also Sam Goldwyn, my favorite, who was famous for his particular ability to mangle the English language. For example, an oral agreement is not worth the paper it's written on. In two words, impossible. Include me out. Yes, I read that script. I read part of it all the way through. When asked about a Western he was making and asked about all of the extras and were they all in line and in order, he said, yep, we got Indians fresh from the reservoir. He's also the first fellow who actually said, anyone who sees a psychiatrist should have his head examined. But my favorite, I don't know who was inspired to invite him to do this, but my favorite is a luncheon that was being given for the great war hero, General Montgomery. And actually, he got through the introduction really rather well until he got to the very, very end. And then he said, with a very humble look on his face, hand on chest at his heart, and ladies and gentlemen, it gives me enormous pleasure. I am so proud to introduce to you Montgomery Ward. But he ran Goldwyn Studios, and he ran them very well. Now, from the very beginning of the movie industry until the end of the 1950s, these men and the studios that they ran controlled the industry. Actors, directors, and most screenwriters, as well as all of the ancillary crafts, worked for one particular studio. And as a matter of fact, they worked at that particular studio, much the way a factory worker worked at his place of business. Each actor was under contract to do a certain number of films each year, and where a major star might reject a particular script, eventually he did have to accept the scripts he or she might not be happy with just to fulfill his contract. And if you didn't, you were put on what they called suspension, which meant that for the duration of the film that you rejected, you would not be paid your salary. That went for all the big stars as well. Lesser actors didn't even have that option. We did the films we were told to do. Major stars were also loaned out to other studios like Chattel. The movie moguls pulled the strings, and the actor puppets sang or danced or acted as the moment called for. Now, of course, all of that has changed, and we are now in the era of independent production where individual groups are headed by a producer for their own company, sometimes for only one film, and the huge studios are no longer the dominant force. And Michael Douglas has done his own movies. Any number of people have done their own movies. Now, I came upon the Hollywood scene toward the end of the big studio era, so I've been involved in both time frames. I was actually discovered by a Hollywood talent scout while I was performing in a dance school recital in New York. I was actually signed by Louis B. Mayer himself, the great man, to the studio of my dreams. It was the studio of my dreams because MGM made all the great, great musicals. My mom and I flew out to Los Angeles to what I was certain was to be a meteoric rise to stardom. Now, the moment I got there, I was actually assigned to a movie. I was going to do a film called The Toast of New Orleans, which was the second film of starring a young hot tenor of the day named Mario Lanza. This was his follow-up film to the first big one. And I was taken to be introduced to Joseph Pasternak, who was producing that movie. He and Arthur Freed were the producers of musical films at MGM. And he was really quite lovely to me. He put his arm around me and he said, "Come on, kid, I'll show you around the MGM lot." Oh boy. At the time I met a young starlet named Debbie Reynolds. I met one who was on the way up named Elizabeth Taylor. I met Judy Garland, who was filming at the time. I met Esther Williams. We used to call her Esther the Backstroke Williams. And then I met on that day Clark Gable. You said it. I nearly wet my knickers. He was gorgeous and very kind and sweet. I soon found out, however, that the studio didn't quite know what to do with me. My dream of becoming the next Lana Turner, you know, that was my dream. I wanted to be Lana Turner. I didn't realize that was simply just an absolute dream. I didn't have role models. I didn't have Salma Hayek. I didn't have Jennifer Lopez. I had no one. I had Lana Turner, so that's what I wanted to be. Well, that dream vanished, and I found myself being cast as you mentioned earlier, a little Conchita Lolicha, or as an Indian maiden, and uttering such deathless lines as, I really did say this line, when I found out the white man, as a little Indian maiden, the white man didn't like me, I said to him, "Why, you no love Ula no more." And when he told me why, I threw myself off a cliff. For that actor? Oh, was I nuts? Anyway, I did do a film with the lady of my dreams. I did do a film with Lana Turner. Oh, my goodness. I was just all eyeballs. And co-starring with her in it was a new, young, hot Latino leading man, Ricardo Montalban. Now, when I wasn't doing something in the film, I only had about 3 scenes, and it was a rather small part. In fact, it was a warning that I wasn't going to be dropped soon because it was a very small part. I was visiting for the 89th time, the set, and just watching. And the assistant director came to me and said, "Rosita," because it hadn't been changed yet to Rita, "Miss Turner left something in the wardrobe department. Would you mind going to the wardrobe department and picking it up for her and bringing it to her dressing room?" I said, "Oh, I'd be thrilled. Great, okay." So I went to the wardrobe department. The wardrobe mistress handed me a little cloth pouch with a drawstring. And she said, in a very kind of harsh tone, she said, "Now listen, I want you to take this directly to Miss Turner's dressing room and do not look inside it." For those who aren't watching, I'm smiling. Well, of course I had a look inside. What was it, you may well ask? It was a padded bra. Heavens! Well, let me tell you something. She really didn't need the help. But everybody in those days that was female and had a chest was padded. Everybody was padded in those days. And I remember once being so heavily padded because I was petite, to say the least. And I remember being so padded that when I bumped into a wall, I ricocheted about 2 feet. Anyway, after about 2 years at MGM, I was dropped. I really felt that my world had ended. Oh, boy, I was heartbroken. I really thought great things were going to happen. But, as is my wont, I persevered. And little by little, I put my life back in order and began to make other films in other places. None of them too memorable, but I did work with some amazing people, movie idols. Susan Hayward, Tyrone Power, Yul Brynner, and Gary Cooper. He was something else. All the others, he really did talk that way. All the others said was, yep. And I remember the first night I met him, I was doing a film with him called The Garden of Evil, in him and Cameron Mitchell and Susan Hayward in Mexico. And I was invited by the director to have dinner with all of them. And all I could do was just stare at him. I don't think I ate a thing. And I kept waiting for him to say something. He never spoke. And finally he got up and the great man spoke. What did he say? He said, "Well, I think I'll go to bed." And that's the last time I heard Gary say anything to anybody except dialogue. I finally got the proverbial big break when I screen-tested and was given the part of Tuptim in The King and I. And it was during the making of the film that I met Jerome Robbins, who was the choreographer on the film, and I think saw something in me. Because a few years after the completion of the film, I received a call from him to tell me that he was going to direct a new play on Broadway called West Side Story, which he told me was loosely based on Romeo and Juliet. And he thought I would be a very interesting choice for the role of Maria. Yes. So my agent called and said, "They're waiting for you. He's anxious to see you. He thinks you'd be so wonderful for this." And I got cold feet. And there was a very good reason for it. I had practically been brought up on movies. In movies, you can just keep doing it till you get it right. You have a director's help. You have cameramen. You have all kinds of things to make you feel actually helpless. And I was scared to death of going on an empty stage in an empty theater with just people staring at me and performing for them. I just didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I could cut it. And probably because I thought that I probably would have failed the audition. At any rate, years later, I went to see the play, and I thought, oh, boy, was that a mistake. Never mind. Sometime in 1959, I received another call from Jerry to tell me that he was going to co-direct with Bob Wise the film version of West Side Story. And at that point, when he saw me, he said, "You know what? I think you really look like an Anita now. I'd like you to audition for the role of Anita." And so I went in to audition. Now, I can tell you that every dark-eyed, dark-haired girl in Hollywood tested for that part. And although I felt somewhat secure about my acting and singing abilities, and I did auditions for both, I sang some songs, and then I read the candy store scene, what is also known as the taunting scene, that went really very, very well, very successful. But then Jerry took me aside after that audition and said to me, "Listen, I really, really like you for this. I think you would be wonderful. But," he said, "you have to audition for the dancing as well." And he said, if you don't cut that, I can't possibly hire you. I can't consider you for this." Well, what I didn't tell them is that I hadn't danced for some 10 years. And besides that, I had never done that kind of dancing in my life, which is called jazz, or I suppose some people call it modern jazz. I wasn't familiar at all with that kind of style or that kind of dancing. I was a Spanish dancer. I did flamenco. I played the castanets, but I'd never done that. And I gulped really hard, and I asked him, "So when would you need to see me dance?" And he said, well, you've really got time because there's so many people we have to see. We have just rafts and rafts of people to see. I would say in a couple of months, I ran to the nearest dancing school and registered from 9 in the morning till 7, 8, or 9 o'clock at night. Now, you really have to be young to withstand that kind of punishment. I mean, imagine somebody saying to you, okay, tomorrow I want you to do 10 sets of tennis every day when you haven't played tennis in 10 years. Same thing. Even worse, though, because for this, the dancing also needs a sense of style. I danced, literally danced my booty off. I took every kind of dance you can imagine to the extent I worked so hard that one teacher one night said to me after the class, I do not want you back in my class ever again. And I said, why? And she said, because, honey, she said, you work so hard that you turn a really deep shade of red and that worries me. And she says, I'm afraid something's going to happen to you and I don't want it to happen in my class. And she was right. I remember going into the ladies' room of the dance school one evening about 8 o'clock and looked in the mirror and my face was not the color of a tomato, it was the color of a beet. And I was burning hot and I had huge goosebumps all over my body. I had raised a fever. I mean, I don't know how, well, I'm very strong. I have enormous stamina and that's how I guess I survived that. Came the end of the 2 months, and I knew I really wasn't ready. And it suddenly occurred to me that I knew a girl who had played Anita on the road in a road company of West Side Story. And I called her up, and I said, Deborah, can you do anything for me? I know I'm really not ready. What can you help me in any way? And she said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will teach you one section. Dancers come in section. I'll teach you one section of America, which they sometimes use for the auditions, but not always. And I'll teach you a section of the mambo at the gym when the Sharks and the Jets are competing with each other. Thank you, thank you. And she worked with me. She worked with me really, really hard. Came the day for the audition, my heart in my mouth. And the assistant director was doing the auditions. And let me tell you what a dance audition is like. Unlike singing and acting auditions, where you bring in your own music or you already have a scene that you've studied, you learn the steps one step at a time and then put them together very, very slowly. And then within 15, 20 minutes, you then have to do it back at the assistant dance director, but with style and with speed. So he said, okay, he took me by the hand. He said, let me teach you the piece of America. And I said, okay. And it was the piece that Deborah had taught me. So he taught me the steps, and I did them back at him. And then after that was over, he said, now let me teach you a piece of the Mambo with the Gym. And again, just, you know, holding my breath. And it was the same piece that Deborah had taught me. And that was that. And then I have to wait and wait and wait. I mean, it was weeks before I heard anything. I heard, and I don't know if this is entirely, maybe it's apocryphal, but I heard that that Jerry called the dance assistant and said to him, I'm dying to know because I really want her. How did she do? And the dance assistant said, well, you know, she's going to need some work. You know, we're going to have to kind of beat it out of her. But he said, boy, does she learn fast. And I got the Oscar and the Golden Globe. Ha ha. Yeah, 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 yeah. I would like to devote the time left to me for a discussion of discrimination in the film industry and its effect on minorities. I certainly exemplify that kind of discrimination. I am a member of a minority. I am a woman, and I am of that certain age, a veritable triple threat. Now, conventional wisdom in the entertainment industry would have it that the percentage of women and other minorities in the film industry has increased significantly over the past 10 to 15 years. Well, you know what? The data does not support this claim. The Screen Actors Guild Employment Statistics Report states that of the approximately 5,400 roles signed to guild contracts in a recent year, only some 20% went to performers of color. Black performers received some 14% of the roles, Hispanics some 4%, with Asians and Native Americans as rare participants in any American film. To better understand the problems, let's categorize the areas of discrimination. Let's start with the woman question. Now, at a time in our history when women drive race cars in the Indianapolis 500, head major corporations, hold high political office, command space missions, and are elected to head the Episcopalian Church, which happened only yesterday, you may recall, with its 77 million members, Hollywood still manages to cling to its own agenda. Consider, 7% of last year's top films were directed by women. 2% have female cinematographers. 13% of films have women writers. 13% of films have women editors. And in total, women make up only 17% of studios' workforce. Despite the fact that there are more women than men in the United States, men receive twice as many roles in film each year and work more than twice as many days as women in a film. Women are usually cast in secondary roles and are, with the possible exception of a few people like Julia Roberts or Nicole Kidman, are rarely thought of as being bankable. On the other hand, a Tom Cruise, a Tom Hanks, a Jack Nicholson, a Clint Eastwood, and any number of other male stars are a guarantee that a film will be made. And then there is the question of age. Men like Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson, Clint Eastwood, Michael Caine, Sean Connery, in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s, are still considered leading men, and more often than not, get the girl at the end of the film, but have a female approach the dreadful and unthought-of age of 40, and her career as a leading lady grinds to a very loud halt. I think of that unbelievably talented Meryl Streep and Sophie's Choice, Kramer versus Kramer, and now The Devil Wears Prada. Now accepting secondary roles in less than brilliant films because, as an actress, she must act. And all because she has reached the unpardonable age of 40. Larry Gelbart, the writer whose film credits include MASH and Tootsie, said that the only way for women to avoid age discrimination in Hollywood was to die young. As for women behind the camera, although there has been some positive movement in the past decade, the disparity of women to men as directors, camera persons, cinematographers is still totally unacceptable. Women writers account for fewer than 15% of screenplays that are produced, and herein lies a curiosity. Starting in 1910 and through the 1920s, women actually wrote some 50% of all the films that were produced during that period. It was considered the golden years for women in film. And then slowly that number diminished, and the reason for the decline is absolutely despicable. During those early days, filmmaking was considered more of a curiosity than a real business. And as soon as filmmaking became recognized as big business, it became the province of the boys' club, and women were eased out of that private organization. One of the major drawbacks for the advancement of women in film is that, with few exceptions, women have not headed major studios, movie studios, that is. One of those rare people might be Sherry Lansing, and there were about two others. But it's also sad, but true, that too often, when these few women do reach a position of power, they too often react by emulating men in the way they have conducted business and in their treatment of women. Interesting, yes? Betty Friedan once wrote, "Who knows what women can be when they are finally free to become themselves?" Great quote. Even more to the point is the remark of Jane Campion, one of only four women directors nominated for an Academy Award. In a talk before a meeting of film directors, she said, "To deny women directors is to deny feminine vision in film." Well, the same thought can be extended to all other minorities whose vision has been denied, and with it, the glory that film can be is diminished. Now let's talk about discrimination based on race. Blacks have been a part of movies since the very beginning of the film industry. However, until the past 30 years or so, they were relegated to the minor roles and almost always portrayed butlers, maids, welfare recipients, or mobsters. It could be called the step and fetch it era, where black actors were assigned roles as characters who were somewhat slow or even dull-witted, shiftless, and singularly lacking in ambition. Of course, there were exceptions, but they were very, very few. Hattie McDaniel won the Academy Award in 1939 for her portrayal as the strong, dignified maid in Gone with the Wind. Unfortunately, the same film had another black actress portraying a somewhat witless maid who was crying, "I don't know nothing about birth and babies." So much for dignity for blacks in Hollywood at that time. One notable exception was the magnificent Paul Robeson, who managed to maintain his dignity and sense of self-worth in film, which becomes quite evident when one goes back to Mr. Robeson in films like Showboat, Emperor Jones, and Othello. However, in refusing to bow to stereotype, his career in films was very short-lived. But things are changing. 24 years after Hattie McDaniel won her Academy Award, 24 years, Sidney Poitier won the award for his role in Lilies of the Field in 1963. Another 39 years, let me say that again, 39 years would pass until Halle Berry and Denzel Washington would both win their Academy Awards in 2002. This paucity of award winners is due not to a lack of talented actors, but to the lack of good roles offered to them. We are seeing more and more actors on screen, black actors like Morgan Freeman, Samuel L. Jackson, Don Cheadle, Danny Glover, Terrence Howard, Halle Berry, Lawrence Fishburne, Angela Bassett, Will Smith, Jamie Foxx, actors who are playing meaningful and at times leading roles. And of course, there's always Denzel Washington, who deservedly has reached the realm of superstar, which means that his name can carry a film. As for blacks behind the camera, the situation, although improved, still leaves a long way to go toward parity with their white counterparts. Yet black directors have made major contributions to motion pictures. But it took people like Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles who, with their strength and talent, broke the barriers of white-only and opened the way for black directors like John Ridley, Ossie Davis, LeVar Burton, Kevin Hooks, Charles S. Dutton, Robert Townsend, Forrest Whitaker, John Singleton, Debbie Allen, Charles Burnett, and, of course, Spike Lee, who were part of the list of some 68 blacks in the Encyclopedia of Hollywood Directors. As for blacks in the other crafts, screenwriters, cinematographers, editors, and producers, you could say that there has been some glacial movement. Now to the roles of Hispanics in film. Here, too, the progress has been positive, and yet, as the fastest-growing group in the country, which has just passed African Americans as the largest minority segment of the population, we still represent only some 5-4% of films made each year. However, we are seeing Hispanic playing roles other than pimps, gang members, and drug pushers, and that is a blessed relief. We also see a larger number of Hispanic actors playing more and more important roles. Actors like Andy Garcia, Hector Elizondo, Jennifer Lopez, Jimmy Smits, Salma Hayek, Benjamin Bratt, Rosie Perez, Martin Sheen, Antonio Banderas, and others. I just found out recently, which is really amuses me to death, that a lot of other Hispanic actors refer to me as La Pionera, the pioneer. For having paved the way for the Hispanic actors who followed. But my husband says that I opened the doors for the other actors since so many doors in my time were closed to me. As for Latinos behind the camera, the situation is really quite discouraging. In spite of the presence of so many talented Hispanic directors, men like Luis Valdez, Gregory Nava, Rodrigo Garcia, and ton of others. In any given year, only about 1% of films produced in Hollywood are directed by Latinos. The situation on the other crafts is equally discouraging. And finally, we come to the biggest tragedy in the movie industry, and that is the place of Asians and Native Americans in film. Now, since Native Americans are practically non-existent in film, they really deserve another lecture to understand the phenomena of their place not only in American film, but also in the other arts, music, dance, architecture, and theater. I will have to leave that very important chore to another. And then on to our Asian brothers and sisters. I think back to a time some 60 or so years ago, and I am absolutely amazed as well as appalled by what Hollywood offered and we accepted as Asian films. I remember a series of films featuring a Chinese detective who, in an inscrutable manner, solved seemingly insoluble mysteries. The ancient detective in the Charlie Chan movies was played by a Swedish actor named Warner Oland, with the corners of his eyes drawn up and equipped with a set of enlarged front teeth. The role was played, he played that role from 1931 to 1938. And after Mr. Oland's early death, he was replaced by a very well-known and respected Chinese actor named Sidney Toland. Can you believe it? Charlie Chan's huge intellect mysteriously did not extend to an ability to master English articles. Quote, "joy in heart more desirable than bullet." He also had a son, the number one son. Remember him? He, you want to talk about ironies, was played by a young Chinese actor. Wow. Even more egregious was the film of Pearl Buck's bestseller, The Good Earth. The producers cast as the leads, playing a Chinese husband and wife, Paul Muni, who came from the Jewish theater, and Louise Reiner, an actress who still had a slight Viennese accent. To make matters even more bizarre, in 1937, Miss Reiner won the Academy Award for that role. Oh, my. Well, that was then. This is now. Anglos no longer play the role of Asians. There's hardly any need to, since they are practically invisible in film. Occasionally, you will find a Sandra Oh, who, by the way, is from Canada, in a film, or a Bruce Lee in a martial arts film, and the very infrequent appearance of an Asian face in an American movie. The only other roles for Asians are in films about Asians, and these films are rarities, and in other words, the Asian actor is definitely not a part of the Hollywood genre. Of course, there's a very active film industry in the Pacific Rim that keeps Asian actors and those behind the camera quite busy. Finally, in our country, there is a slow awakening to the richness the Asian community has to offer. At the Asian Pacific Film Festival held in L.A. just this past month, young Asian filmmakers gave a glimpse of their talent, and at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, a young screenwriter, Milton Liu, won the most prestigious award for his screenplay. So there is a forward movement. I'd like to close my talk with a very personal story which might encapsulate in a personal way the true impact of Hollywood discrimination. Some years ago, I received a script from I was 60 then, and by the way, hadn't worked for quite some time. I would say about 3 years, which is a long time for an actor. I got a script for a Kevin Costner movie, and there was a wonderful featured role for an older actress, supposed to be an over-the-hill actress. It was delicious. There was only about 4 scenes, but they were just standout scenes. And I was delighted. I said, oh, I got this nailed. I know I can do this with my eyes closed. And my agent sent me to meet the director, and I said to the director as I walked into his office, I can't wait to read for you because I just think I know what is called for in this role. And she was funny and she was fiery, not Latina, by the way, all of those things. And I mentioned the character's name, and he said to me, oh, no, no, no. He said, no, that's not the part we wanted to see you for. We wanted to see you for the part of the Mexican whorehouse madam. Well, I don't even know how to begin to tell you how I felt. It's as though he suddenly just erased all of those years of hard work, all of those amazing awards that sit on my shelf with that one little remark. And it was a scene, she had three scenes in which she actually had two lines. And for this, he had to see me. And I mustered myself and, you know, just pulled myself up to my 5'3" height. But I tell you, I felt 6 feet tall. And I said, I don't do Mexican whorehouse madams. And but I went into the car and wept and wept and wept. A 60-year-old woman. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's even hard for me to talk about it now. It stings. So, in spite of my personal setbacks and the much more general problems of a still provincial Hollywood, I remain hopeful. As is stated in the Bible, Zechariah 9:12, I am a prisoner of hope. I really believe that there are meaningful changes taking place in Hollywood, and we're going to see to it. The future for making film appears to be brighter. We have only to open the door and say, come on in and join the party. And thank you for asking me here today.
Our thanks to Rita Moreno, actress, singer, dancer, and social activist, for her comments today. I am Rose Gilbo, and I'm the past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be moderating tonight's question and answer period. We have a large number of questions. We don't have time for a lot, so I'm going to choose the top ones.
Okay.
You tell a lot of funny stories about you and your mother, which are very charming. But I get the sense that there was incredible strength between the two of you, a single mother with a 5-year-old child immigrating to the United States, living in a difficult situation. What was the role that your mother played to make you the success you are today?
She was an amazing woman. She was very resourceful. She did learn English. My mother could do anything that she had to do in order to make a living. At one point, my mother, when things were really bad, became an assistant chef in an Italian restaurant. I said, Mom, you don't cook Italian? She said, I do now. she could do everything. She made all my costumes for me. I was dancing from the time I was 5. And she taught me how to sew sequins on costumes. So I used to help her with my costumes. She had several jobs at one time. And I remember helping her make crepe paper roses for Woolworths. That was one of her extra jobs. She sewed. She cleaned houses. She did everything that she had to do to see that her little girl had a better a life. But it was a strain. It was very, very, very difficult.
Was show business her dream or your dream?
I don't even know how to answer that, because really I was dancing from the time I was 5. And a friend of hers, when we came from Puerto Rico, before I could even speak English, saw me prancing around in the living room and said, oh, Rosita has to go to dancing school. She was a Spanish dancer, and she took me to get lessons with a man named Paco Cancino, who turned out was Rita Hayworth's uncle. She was Margarita Cancino originally. And it just seemed the most natural thing in the world. So I guess it was me, and then it was her ambition for me that drove it.
Well, you know, we have to ask this question. Please talk about Marlon Brando.
Talk about him?
Yes, well, and what was...
I hate general questions. Like, I mean,
what was your fondest
say?
Memories of him Fond- is what this was, question is.
Okay, he was one of the funniest men alive. He was really, really extremely witty and very, very funny. He was horrible to women. And he was a sexy guy. I'm going to put this in a nutshell. I mean, what can I say? Did you see that picture of myself and him that was auctioned at Christie's for $47,000? I gave him that picture. What an idiot I was. He was a He was a difficult person. He was a wonderful actor. He gave me some good acting advice once. When I asked him, when he was doing The Young Lions, where he was playing a Nazi, I said, how do you play a bad person? And he said, well, you don't play a bad person. You find every good reason in the world for doing what you do, and you find all kinds of rationales, and you're not a bad person. You have to do these things because there is a larger vision in mind. And it's something I've always remembered, and it helps with Amanda in the Glass Menagerie because she's sometimes a bit of a monster, but you never, never, ever play. Someone's nodding vigorously, yes. But she's, you know, there are other aspects to her that break your heart as well.
You know, you're talking about West Side Story, which is so iconic to all of us, you know, when we think about you, when we think about great American musical theater. But yet, you were the only main Latina who was in West Side Story, and this was a story about gang members.
Oh,
Natalie Wood was white, or Russian, I guess.
Yeah. There's several reasons in a way. At the time, I think it was hard to find Hispanic boys and girls who could dance that kind of dance. And there was a very good reason for it. They couldn't afford dance class. So a lot of it was a native talent, but they couldn't quite cut that kind of thing. I mean, that's really a very legitimate reason. You see a lot of black dancers nowadays and Hispanic kids and a lot of Asian kids dancing, but things have changed in that respect. But there were, listen, there's no question that there were stereotypes in mind because we all had to wear the same color makeup, very, 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 very dark makeup. And apparently this was Jerome Robbins' doing. He wanted a real contrast between the Sharks and the Jets. In fact, he had some of the Jet boys, the Anglo boys, he had them bleach their hair blonde. Which is, and then, you know, this is a man who brought this amazing play to fruition, but all of that was still existing then. I hated the makeup. I remember one shot of George Chakiris, he's that beautiful face of his, where he looked like he'd been dipped in a bucket of mud.
Yeah, Natalie Wood too didn't really look very Latina.
Natalie, I talk about, oh my goodness, talk about counterintuitive casting. Mm-hmm. But she wasn't comfortable in that role. She really wasn't. She realized that she'd made a terrible, terrible mistake, but it was too late. And she found it very difficult to be around us, the dancers, not because she was in any way disrespectful, on the contrary, but she was uncomfortable because she knew that she wasn't really a Maria and that she had a terrible time doing the few dance steps that she did do. I remember in the scene where she, Maria and Tony, meet across the room in the Mambo at the gym, where we did about 64 takes of one little section of the dance because, I mean, it seems to me that Jerome Robbins could have helped her more by giving her easier steps, but that wasn't Jerome Robbins. He had to do it his way.
You've had such wonderful roles. We've enumerated them. Carnal Knowledge, you know, West Side Story, etc. What was your favorite role?
It has to be Anita. I mean, it gave me world celebrity. It got me two astonishing awards. But you know what I also love? I thought Carnal Knowledge was an extraordinary movie, and it was a. I think it was one of those what is porn kind of movies that would have to be judged in some kind of court. I don't remember exactly what that case was about, but it was one of those. It was decided this was not porn. It was a very bold and brave movie.
It was. What about this person would like to know what your favorite co-star is?
Actually, Marlon. We did a movie together called The Night of the Following Day, and it was the first time I'd ever done improvisation because he hated the dialogue. Marlon always said yes to scripts and then ended up hating them once he was shooting them and made directors crazy and actors crazy. And in the film we did, it ended up that he wasn't talking to the director, and I was the middleman who had to say, Marlon says... Marlon's right here on my left side. Marlon says that he doesn't want to do it because such and such. He'd rather do this. And then director said, would say, well, tell Marlon that. I said, did you hear that? Oh, it was murder. But he was so much fun to act with, because everything we did together in that film, all our scenes, were improvised, and I'd never done that before. It was great. I loved it.
That's great. Now, if you were starting over again today, what Plum role would you want?
I would have taken that role in West Side Story. I would have auditioned for that damn thing.
Well, this
I regret that very much.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this person would like to know, if you were her age, would you want the Eva Longoria role on Desperate Housewives?
No.
Why?
Well, I'm just not crazy about that show. So let's leave it at that. It's not Eva Longoria. The show doesn't interest me that much.
Is there anything else other than West Side Story that seems exciting to you today in terms of film or plays that
Oh, God, there are wonderful things going on. There's some terrific young actors right now. You know, people always think of the older actors, people like Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn and Gable, as great actors, and many of them really were not. They were great personalities. Gable wasn't a great actor. Ava Gardner was probably one of those world's most beautiful women. She was a terrible actress, but you went to see them because they were personalities. Now, right now, we have astonishingly talented young actors. I love watching them. I love them, and I envy them. How wonderful to be in a position to play these unusual and interesting roles.
Is there a role that's out there that you would love to do right now that's still out there for you?
Oh, I would say there are about 30 of them.
Which is at the top?
At the top, gee, there really isn't. Well, I want to look at some plays for... First of all, I'm thinking of doing a one-woman, This Is My Life kind of show, which would be done at... it would start at Bertley Grepp and possibly maybe move on to... bigger fields and that kind of thing. I've been putting it off for a long time, and so many people have said, either, when are you going to write a book, or when are you going to do a one-woman show? So having seen Elaine Stritch's, which I thought was just fabulous, I thought, well, maybe I'll take a stab at that. And Les Waters, who's here, our director of Glass Menagerie, is going to do all of the interviewing, and we're going to have a lot of fun and a lot of wine. And I hope a life story emerges sooner or later.
I have seen you perform cabaret, and you're equally fabulous as a singer and a dancer as an actress.
Oh, I love doing cabaret, because that's really acting set to music. Those are monologues set to music. So inevitably, of course, I will always find songs that have a story, and what are known in the musical theater as book songs, songs that belong in a situation within a musical play. I love that.
Yeah.
That's
fun. And you're fabulous at it.
Thank you.
I know that you mentioned early on, and I think we're going to have this be the last question today, mm-hmm. that you've been married for 41 years, which is quite extraordinary in showbiz.
The only marriage, too. That's what's really extraordinary.
Is it the only one married?
Yeah.
Well, what is the secret to your long, successful marriage?
Well, aside from the fact that I'm married to a man who really is my anchor, who is sane, I mean, I could never marry someone like me. It's not, but, well, no, you can't. The other thing, actors marrying actors is not such a good idea. And I think what won me over the most was his sense of humor. I'll give you one quick example. we got a little puppy once. We bought a puppy in a supermarket. A little girl was selling puppies in a box, and we never had a dog, either of us, in our lives. And then we paid a quarter for this puppy, took it to the pet shop next door, and said, now what do we do? And the gentleman said, well, here's what you do. He's too young, really, to be at home. He should still be with his mother. But now that you got him, put him in a nice warm blanket, like in the kitchen, if a clock, which will probably help him, put a nice warm a hot water bottle in there. And as you leave the kitchen, take with you two pie tins and close the door, put the pie tins on the floor. And I said, yeah, why? He said, well, he's so young that he's inevitably going to start howling at 2 or 3 in the morning. And what you do is you go to the door, do not open it, take the pie tins, and bang them as loud as you can through the door, and through the door say, no, 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 and bang them again, throw them on the floor. And I said, why? And he said, but it'll startle him, so that whenever he barks at night, it will startle him, and within a day or two, he will stop the howling. Because he said, I promise you, if you don't do that, he's really going to wake you up every night for a month. And I thought it was a horribly cruel thing, but I thought, well, maybe we don't want to wake up at 2 in the morning every night for a month. Sure enough, at about 2 in the morning, and little dogs have the hugest voices. So I get out of bed, and I shuffle to the door. I pick up the pie tins and bang, 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 rattle, 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 bang, and I hit the door with it. I was really doing a job, and I threw them on the floor so they clattered even more, and I shuffled back to bed, and as I get into bed, my husband says, my God, when you Puerto Ricans give parties. And there are more, but that's maybe for another time.
Our thanks to Rita Moreno, actress, singer, dancer, and social activist, for joining us. We also thank everyone in the audience. And now the program for the Commonwealth Club commemorating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.